Well, let's begin for our last seminar with Joseph Prabhu on Ramandu Panikkar.
Panikkar, yeah.
Over to you.
Thank you. Well, as Gavin mentioned, this is my last, but as I was telling Nina and Rambert and Bhushan, I am here till the 12th of October, of December. So while this is the last formal lecture, I certainly hope to participate in the life of the center for at least another 2.5 weeks.
Excellent.
But as this is my last formal sort of lecture, again, I want to reiterate my thanks to all of you who've been very, very kind. I've had a good and productive time. And as I was telling Gavin, I hope to be back. So,
great.
For those of you for whom that is ghastly news, take it with some stoicism. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's get down to business. I am happy to talk about Ramundo or Raimon Panikkar. I mean, the name itself is interesting because it went through, it's like Gandhi changing his clothes, you know, I mean, and acquiring a different persona. I mean, and partly because I don't want to spend too much time on the name and Nama Rupa, but there were at least three different names, first names, because his father had a British passport and British citizenship. So when Panikkar at least first came to India, which was in the mid-50s. He was known as Raymond, and then he sort of took back a more sort of Spanish Castilian name, Raimundo. But when he retired from the University of California, Santa Barbara in 87, he became Raimon, which is very much a Catalonian name, and I understood that transition, because for those of you familiar with the history of Spain, Catalonia, that was quite anti-Franco and anti-sort of Madrid, really wanted to revive its own language and its own culture. And interestingly enough, for those of you who are linguists, Catalan is much closer to French and to Italian than it is to Castilian Spanish. So when you listen to it and even read it, it's quite a different language. Anyway, so Raimon Panikkar, to take the last of his avatars. I am happy to do it in this center in particular, because from at least the time that I've spent here with many of you, one of the things that to me makes this center very attractive is that it has kept its scholarly integrity at a time when the study of Hinduism, at least in India, is getting increasingly politicized. So it is a great relief to see a place where scholarship and scholarly integrity are taken seriously. And that means that the openness of that Hinduism and Hindu studies traditionally have had to dialogue, to cognate disciplines, I think is also sort of mark of this of this center. What I'm going to be talking about today is, I'm going to do two things, and then if we have time, maybe a little bit of a third. The two main things that I want to do, as I imagine that Panikkar is not well known here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is anyone who's made a deep study of Panikkar? No, I didn't think so. So that the first task will be at least to tell you a little bit about him so that you know where he's coming from. And the second is because he is one of the pioneers in the 20th century of both interreligious dialogue, broadly speaking, and Hindu religious and Hindu-Christian dialogue specifically, it's important to at least spell out what his dialogical attitudes and principles are, and you'll see that there are interesting parallels with Paul Ricoeur that some of you have studied. I know Lucien has. But Panikkar's philosophy of dialogue has interesting parallels with Ricoeur's, who was a very close friend of his. The third thing that I hope to do is to show how this particular understanding of dialogue affected Panikkar's thinking as a Christian. But I'll remark on something that it's on the website, that Panikkar, who was the son of a Indian Hindu father from Kerala, and from the sort of broadly Shaivite tradition, and a Spanish or Catalonian Catholic mother, grew up in rather traditional Catholic upbringing, and even though he had a great Sanskrit teacher, the great translator Juan Mascaro, who translated the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and so on, still was not really exposed to the religion of his father till he was 36 and came to India for the first time. But it marked him profoundly, and just one mark of that profound encounter was that in his last will and testament, he specified that he wanted to be cremated, and that half his ashes were going to be buried in the cemetery where he was a priest in Tavarteth, but the other half were going to be immersed in the Ganges behind his house in Benares. He had a house in Benares where tons of students, especially from Europe, would come to sort of study with him, and the other half was buried in the Hindu ceremony. In the Ganges, so that's the sort of broad map of what I want to trace. So I'm going to read a short piece that I wrote for the Journal of Hindu Christian Studies, which gets published from the University of Notre Dame. And some of you, I mean, you must be getting that in the library here, right? Because it's both online and it's a very Frank Clooney is very much involved in that, and it's the premier journal for Hindu Christian sort of dialogue, at least in the U.S. And this was written for that, and it's called Adieu, sort of punning on the Adieu in French, Raymond Panikkar. Professor Raymond Panikkar, one of the greatest scholars of the 20th century in the areas of comparative religion, theology, and interreligious dialogue, died at his home in Tavertet near Barcelona, Spain, on August 26th at the age of 91. This was an obituary notice that came in the journal. He taught and lived in the United States for a good part of each year from 1966 to 1987, and was known to generations of students there and around the world through both his lectures and his many books, 60-plus books in 6 languages, yet an amazing gift for languages. What they heard and read were the arresting reflections of a multidimensional person who was simultaneously a philosopher, theologian, translator, mystic, priest, and poet, who won many literary prizes as well. He was born the son of an Indian Hindu father and a Spanish Catholic mother on November the 3rd, 1918. He received a conventional Catholic education at a Jesuit high school in Barcelona before launching on his university studies in the natural sciences, philosophy, and theology. And he ended up getting doctorates in all three, including in chemistry among the natural sciences. Shortly thereafter, first in Barcelona, his first the site of study, and then in Madrid. Shortly thereafter, the Spanish Civil War broke out, and Panikkar was able to take advantage of his status as the son of a father who, though an Indian, was a British citizen, and on that basis was able to go to the University of Bonn in Germany to continue his studies. However, when World War II started in 1939, Panikkar returned to Spain and completed the first of his three doctorates, this one in philosophy at the University of Madrid in 1946. It was around 1940 that he met Escriva de Balaguer, the founder of Opus Dei, with whom he had a close relationship. It was at Escriva's urging that he trained for the Catholic priesthood and was ordained in 1946. Panikkar continued to be associated with Opus Dei for about 20 years, breaking effectively with the organization, which, as some of you know, is highly controversial, at least in Catholic circles and perhaps Christian circles, breaking effectively with the organization only in the early 1960s. He was tight-lipped about this period of his life, saying only that he did not regret it. It is clear, however, that when one compares the Panikkar of the 1940s and the early 50s with the later Panikkar, better known to the world as a pioneer of interreligious dialogue, that he had moved a long way away from his early roots. It was only in late 1954, when he was already 36, that Panikkar visited India, the land of his father, for the very first time. It proved to be a watershed, a decisive reorientation of his interests and of his theology. He had entered a dramatically new world, religious and cultural, from the Catholic Europe of his youth. The transformation, in his case, was aided by his meetings and close friendships with three monks who, like him, were attempting to live an incarnate Christian life in Indian, predominantly Hindu and Buddhist forms: Jules Moschaner, Henri Lassau, also known as Swami Abhishiktananda, and Bede Griffiths of this very university, the English Benedictine monk, whose dates are 1906 to 1993. By the way, Bede Griffiths was a classmate of C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis dedicates his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, to Bede Griffiths. And as I was telling Gavin over lunch, I knew Bede quite well, because Bede, who rather dramatically, because he was a poet, said he had come to India to find the other half of his soul, that other half being the sort of feminine half, and there's a whole set of discourses on Shakti and the feminine principle and so on in Bede's writings. But the point of some interest is that Bede took over a Hindu-Christian ashram in the south of India, near the banks of the Kaveri. And I spent significant time at the ashram, and many interesting experiments in science. The great botanist, whose name is on the tip of my tongue, who is also an Oxford man, and it'll come back, I'm sure. Who's achieved quite a lot of fame in the philosophy of in his botanical studies, spent time there, as indeed the artist whose paintings I see quite a lot at homes, at least some homes in Oxford, Jyoti Sahi, who also was Bede Griffiths. It bugs me that I can't, this is the old age computer not working all that well today. But anyway, suddenly it'll sort of come to me, I'm sure, the name of this scientist who's quite well known. Anyway, so Panikkar was in touch with all three of these monks, and all four of them, in different ways, discovered and cherished the riches and the deep spiritual wisdom of the Indic traditions, and attempted to live out and express their core Christian convictions in Hindu and Buddhist forms. To some extent, this multiple belonging was made possible by their embrace of Advaita, or what they interpreted Advaita to be, the Indic different in all four cases. The Indic idea of non-dualism, which sees the deep, often hidden connections between traditions without in any way minimizing the differences between them. One of Panikkar's many striking sentences, looking back on his life's journey, asserts, quote, "I left India for Europe as a Christian. I discovered I was a Hindu and returned as a Buddhist without ever having ceased to be a Christian." It's a typical Panikkarian sort of formulation. He loved paradox, but he wasn't being polemical or paradoxical, as I'll try to explain. A wealth of meaning lies in that seemingly paradoxical assertion. Christianity in its historical evolution began as a Jewish tradition and then spread to the Greco-Roman world, acquiring along the way quite diverse Greek and Roman cultural expressions, which have given it in the West a certain form and character. Panikkar, having grown up and having been trained in a traditional Catholic and Neo-Thomist environment, had a profound knowledge of and respect for that tradition. This knowledge prepared him for discussions with some of the great minds of 20th century Catholicism, Jean Danielou, the brother, by the way, of Alain Danielou, the musicologist, Yves Congar, Hans Urs von Balthasar, and many others. He was also invited, that is Panikkar, to take part in the Synod of Rome and the Second Vatican Council, and as I was telling Rembert, he had a significant role in the formulation of one of the documents of the Second Vatican Council called Nostra Aetate, in our age, which has to do with the relationship of Christianity with non-Catholic and non-Christian faiths. But Panikkar did not confuse or conflate historical contingency with spiritual truth. In Hinduism and Buddhism, Panikkar found other languages, in addition to biblical Hebrew, Greek philosophy, and Latin Christianity, to express the core convictions, the kerygma, of the Christian tradition. That was the main thesis of his third doctoral thesis, which later got published as The Unknown Christ of Hinduism, which Panikkar originally presented as a doctoral thesis to the Lateran University of Rome in 1961, based as it was on a close textual comparison and exegesis of the texts of Thomas Aquinas and Shankara's interpretation of the Brahma Sutras. Christ and his teaching are not, so Panikkar argues, the monopoly or exclusive property of Christianity seen as a historical religion. Rather, Christ is the universal symbol of divine human unity, the human face of God. Christianity approaches Christ in a particular and unique way, informed by its own history and spiritual evolution. But Christ vastly transcends Christianity. Panikkar calls the name Christ the supername, in line with St. Paul's line, "It's the name above every other name," from Philippians 2:9, because it is a name that can and must assume other names. That supername can and must assume other names like Rama or Krishna or Ishvara. This theological insight was crucial for Panikkar because it provided the basis of the inter-religious dialogue that he and Swami Abhishekdananda and Bede Griffiths were both advocating and practicing themselves. Far from diluting or in any way watering down core Christian beliefs and practices, such dialogue, in addition to fostering inter-religious understanding and harmony, provided an indispensable medium for deepening the Christian faith. That's very important to realize, that this was not in any way a sort of ironic or purely conversational dialogue for the sake of peace or understanding. This was really seen by Panikkar and by Bede Griffiths and others as essential to their Christian faith, as a way of deepening it. By the way, the Christian theologian Paul Nitter, who has a similar, like Panikkar, but not as vast, Buddhist and Christian identity, has recently written a book which is, expresses the thought that I'm trying to express here in a very catchy way, where Paul Nitter's title is, "Without the Buddha, I would not be a Christian." That's something to tell fundamentalists. I mean, that's a nice slogan. Yeah. So it's an indispensable medium for deepening the Christian faith. Such dialogue provides an insight, an entry point into other non-Christian names and manifestations of the Christ. This was particularly important for Panikkar because, together with other Asian theologians, he saw how historical Christianity had attempted, especially during its colonial periods, to convert Christ into an imperial god with a license to conquer and triumph over other gods. So this is his, if you want, his political theology. This, for Panikkar, is the challenge of the post-colonial period, inaugurated in the mid to late 20th century and continuing into our present and future. In his words, that is Panikkar's, quote, "To the third Christian millennium is reserved the task of overcoming a tribal Christology by a Christophany which allows Christians to see the work of Christ everywhere without assuming that they have a better grasp or a monopoly of that mystery which has been revealed to them in a unique way." End of quote. Needless to say, such striking ideas, carefully and rigorously argued and dramatically expressed, got the attention of religious thinkers and secular institutions around the world. It also got the attention of the Vatican, but I'll come to that in a minute. Panikkar was invited to teach in Rome and then at Harvard from 1966 to 71, and then the University of California, Santa Barbara, from 1971 to 1987. He was now, as Leonard Swidler, the occupant of the chair of Catholic thought at Temple University, called him, quote, "the apostle of interfaith dialogue and of intercultural understanding." Conversant in a dozen or so languages and fluent and writing in at least six, he traveled tirelessly around the world, lecturing, writing, preaching, and conducting retreats. His famous Easter service in his Santa Barbara days would attract visitors from all corners of the globe. Well before dawn, they would climb up a mountain near his home in Montecito, Santa Barbara, meditate quietly in the darkness at 4 o'clock in the morning once they reached the top, and then salute the sun as it arose over the horizon. Panikkar would then bless the elements, air, earth, water, fire, and the sky, and all the surrounding forms of life, plant, animal, and human, and then celebrate Mass and the Eucharist. It was a profound cosmotheandric, this is a word that I'll explain in a minute, a cosmotheandric celebration with the human, the cosmic, and the divine dimensions of life being affirmed, reverenced, and brought into a deep harmony. The celebration after the formal service at Panikkar's home resembled in some respects the Feast of Pentecost as described in the New Testament, where peoples of many different tongues engaged in animated conversation. At the center of these celebrations, retreats, and lectures stood Panikkar himself and his arresting personality. People who heard or encountered him could not help but be struck by this physically small man who, however, packed a punch and who managed to combine in his person the quiet dignity of a sage, the profundity of a scholar, the depth of a contemplative, and the warmth and charm of a friend in his sparkling persona. Not surprisingly, he was invited to universities around the world, Catholic and non-Catholic, to give lectures. To mention just a few among the hundreds that he delivered, he was invited to give the William Noble Lecture at Harvard in 1973, the Thomas Merton Lecture at Columbia in 82, the Cardinal Bellarmine Lecture at the University of St. Louis in 1991. The most prestigious invitation, however, came from the University of Edinburgh, where Panikkar delivered the Gifford Lectures in 1989. These have recently been published by Orbis Books as The Rhythm of Being, and I'm happy to have written the foreword to that book. Panikkar thus joined the select company of William James, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer, and Reinhold Niebuhr, to mention just a few of the most famous Gifford lecturers. He was, in fact, the first Indian and the first Asian, and so far both first still stand invited to give these lectures. Ours is a new era in world history, but thanks to globalization and the increasing communication between cultures and religions, it is vital that there be a well-developed theology of religions in their encounter. Panikkar was one of the pioneering and paradigmatic theologians of this new era. He has left us a rich and many-sided legacy, from the liturgical and the pastoral to the theological and the sapiential. It behooves us who follow him to notice, absorb, and extend that legacy. Remember that this was an obituary notice. So that's a sort of brief introduction to Panikkar as a person. It struck me as being important to do that because not only because of this dual identity of being Hindu and Catholic at the same time and being fully Hindu and fully Catholic, but also because the worldview that he evolved came out of that dialogue and that's what I want to move to now. So. How Panikkar understood dialogue. So let me, just by way of introducing this sort of second section, say that broadly speaking, Panikkar was attempting something new and radical in and through dialogue. So first of all, just to sort of locate dialogue in some of the attitudes, which by no means exhaustive. So many dialogues or so-called dialogues turn out to be polemical, which is really a sort of chance, unfortunately too common, to attack and to belittle sort of other traditions, all right? So you can call polemic. On the other side of the spectrum is something that's called apologetics, which is, as Cardinal Newman, apologia pro vita sua, where in the Latin meaning of the word apologia, it's a defense and a justification. Dialogue is different from both of these because it's an attempt to understand both one's similarities and differences with the tradition or the person that one is dialoguing with. Panikkar, however, goes a step further in his philosophy of dialogue. Because for him, dialogue, given especially his dual Hindu-Catholic identity, was a way of deepening both traditions and transforming them so that it wasn't just this attempt to see what the differences and similarities are. It's a way of entering existentially into a self-questioning, a self-interpretation, and a self-transformation. Some of the theological formulations that I will be presenting in very rudimentary form come out of this dialogue, and that's why it's important to understand his sort of philosophy of dialogue. So this section is called The Encounter of Religions in a Globalized World, Provocations from Panikkar. And I want to begin with a quote by a very close friend and a well-known historian of religions, Ewart Cousins, who I think caught the special importance of Panikkar quite well. And here's a quote from Ewart Cousins. Among those who have made the transition to the future, that is the 21st century, some have become mediators of the future for others who can and perhaps want to make the passage to the future. I suggest that Raimon Panikkar is such a spiritual mutant, one in whom the global mutation has occurred, and in whom the new forms of consciousness have been concretized. They are cross-cultural, for in them the great cultural traditions, formerly distinct through their diverse historical origin and development, now converge or start to converge, making these mutants heirs for the first time in history to the spiritual heritage of humankind. As such, they become multidimensional, for they combine the polarities of the East and the West, outer and inner consciousness, science and mysticism, mythic and rational thinking, pragmatic involvement in the world, and spiritual detachment. That's from Ewart Cousins, talking about Panikkar. So here's my text. One of the consequences of contemporary globalization has been the encounter of religions and religious personalities. While it is true that in pluralistic countries like India and the United States, religions have for long been in contact with one another, this contact intensifies under the compression of time and space that is a structural feature of globalization. This meeting of religions has had decidedly mixed results so far. On the one hand, there has been genuine dialogue and the transformation that goes along with such dialogue. But on the other hand, the encounter has also produced much antagonism and often violence and misunderstanding. In circumstances such as these, it is instructive to revisit the thought of Raymond Panikkar, one of the pioneers in the 20th century of inter- and intra-faith dialogue. Panikkar's rich reflection and dialogue was, however, part of a comprehensive worldview which both framed and reflected it. It is important to emphasize this because his contribution is often, especially in parts of the West, restricted to his practice of dialogue. As a corrective to this somewhat reductive view, it is salient to point out that his practice of dialogue was itself part of an overarching philosophy of dialogue, and the latter, that is, the philosophy of dialogue in turn, can be seen as an offshoot of his pluralistic worldview. I shall accordingly divide this presentation into two sections. The first will deal with his metaphysical worldview, the second with the different dimensions of his philosophy of dialogue. So the first, his worldview, that he calls cosmotheandrism. Panikkar's cosmotheandrism. What for long has driven and unified Panikkar's thinking has been his cosmotheandric vision of reality, what he calls the trinity of cosmic matter, human consciousness, and divine freedom in co-constitutive relationality. These three basic and irreducible dimensions of reality interpenetrate and exist only in relation to each other. This is a sort of radically Buddhist view. There is a kind of perichoresis, that's the Greek word for sort of interrelationship, dwelling within one another of these three dimensions of reality, the divine, the human, and the cosmic. And then again another quote from Panikkar. There is no matter without spirit, and no spirit without matter, no world without man, no God without the universe, etc. God, man, this is his language, so you'll have to excuse the, I'm being faithful to it. God, man, and world are three artificially substantivized forms of the three primordial adjectives which describe reality. Panikkar's use of the theological term perichoresis, taken from the discussions about the Trinity by the Greek fathers, and paralleling in a loose manner the three moments of the eternal dance of Shiva Nataraja, creation, destruction, and preservation, is deliberate and is designed to articulate its Trinitarian structure. The main thesis that Panikkar wants to proffer is the triadic structure of reality, comprising the divine, the human, and the cosmic, in thoroughgoing relationality. In saying that God, quote, that God, man, and world are three artificially substantivized forms of the adjectives which describe reality, Panikkar is pointing to his own version of the Buddhist Pratitya Samutpada, the espousal of what he calls radical relativity. There are no such things or beings as God or man or world considered as completely independent entities. Not only are they dependent on each other, but this dependent is not just external, but rather internal, that is, constitutive of their very being. Panikkar coins the term interindependence to express this relationship and this mutual coming into being. As to the appropriateness of taking a Christian theological symbol to describe what is essentially a philosophical and poetic and universal vision, Panikkar makes at least three responses. First, the symbol of the Trinity is not a Christian monopoly, but is in fact common in many other traditions. Secondly, the relationships and the movements within the Trinity provide a precise and vivid model for the dynamism of the different dimensions of reality that Panikkar wants to articulate. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury and a significant theologian in his own right, has captured this dynamism well in a perceptive essay on Panikkar entitled Trinity and Pluralism, in which Rowan Williams writes, quote, "For Panikkar, the Trinitarian structure is that of a source inexhaustibly generative and always generative, from which arises form and determination, being in the philosophical sense and the sense of what can be concretely perceived and engaged with. That form itself is never exhausted, never limited by this or that specific realization, but is constantly being realized in the flux of active life that equally springs out from the source of all. Between form or logos on the one hand and life and spirit on the other, there is unceasing interaction. The source of all does not and cannot exhaust itself simply in producing shape and structure. It also produces that which dissolves and reforms all structures in endless and undetermined movement in such a way that form itself is not absolutized, but always turned back towards its primal reality or source." All right, and this again is another version of, or it is Rowan Williams' commentary of the Buddhist sort of sutra, if you want, that emptiness is form, form emptiness. Third, even for Christians, Panikkar feels that the doctrine of the Trinity should not be treated, as it often is, as a recondite teaching about the inner life of God cut off from the rest of life and experience. Rather, so potent and rich a symbol is it that it invites further deepening and development, preferably by intercultural and interreligious communication. Panikkar is by no means alone in wanting to articulate the logic of the Trinity philosophically and with reference to the whole of reality. Thus, Hegel likewise saw the Christian Trinity as the Grundstruktur, the basic foundation for his entire dialectic, and conceived of his philosophy as a translation of the doctrinal core of Trinitarian Christianity. Of course, Panikkar's is a quite different philosophical style than Hegel's, but the aim in both cases is the same, to expand and articulate Christian doctrine as a model of reality. In offering the Christian symbol of the Trinity as a resource for interpreting reality and in showing its homeomorphic equivalence to the Hindu notion of Advaita, Panikkar is engaging in an exercise of comparative theology where symbols of particular traditions are shared with the idea of testing their applicability and fruitfulness to contexts beyond their original ones. This is a process that Panikkar describes as, within quotes, mutual fecundation, end of quote. This ontological pluralism matches a corresponding epistemological pluralism where Panikkar attempts to fuse three modes of thought, sensibility and consciousness, which he calls mythos, logos and noema. The mutual relation between these three notions can be succinctly expressed. Mythos is the unthought, logos is that which is thought, while the noema is the unthinkable. The mythos is the unthought because it is the background, the source and origin of what is thought, and therefore cannot be made the object of thought. Logos covers the whole range of thought, from sensibility at the lower end of the cognitive spectrum to speculative ideas at the higher end, what the tradition of German idealism designates as Verstand and Vernunft, and what medieval Latin tradition called ratio and intellectus. The noema is the ever-new, the unpredictable, the wind that blows where it will. As Panikkar expresses it, quote, "The unthinkable does not exist in itself as a fixed dimension. At any given moment, it is the provisional, the historical, that accomplishes itself in the future in hope. Receiving the noema is a permanent passage, a pasha, a pilgrimage. The procession from mythos through logos to noema is endless. Precisely the pneumatic dimensions guarantees, the pneumatic dimension guarantees the constant openness into which we may take a step forward," end of quote. Panikkar's Advaita is, in a sense, a via media between the rationalistic dialectic of a Spinoza or a Hegel tending towards monism and the non-rational Advaita of a Shankara or a Ramanuja. Like the former, that is Hegel and Spinoza, Panikkar regards the world as fully real and reason as an essential instrument in our engagement with it. Unlike them, however, for Panikkar, reason is only an aspect, crucial and essential as it is, of a wider dance or procession of consciousness that also incorporates the mythic and the pneumatic. Like the latter, that is Shankara or Ramanuja, he wants to overcome the dualism of knower and known without, on the one hand, postulating the self-thinking thought of Hegel, who follows Aristotle here, or on the other hand, wanting to transcend religion completely. Furthermore, unlike Shankara, Panikkar does not see the world as mere appearance or maya. There is thus, at both ontological and epistemological levels, a relational energy at the heart of Panikkar's Weltanschauung, an energy that he refers to by various symbolic notions that he calls variously Advaita, Pratitya Samutpada, Trinity, Perichoresis, Dance, and finally, in his last book, his Gifford Lectures, The Rhythm of Being, all of which are homeomorphic equivalents. The Trinity is the ontological foundation of Panikkar's multifaceted doctrine of pluralism, which is a quite different notion from what is usually understood by that term. In the debates between exclusivists, inclusivists, and pluralists, pluralism has come to mean, in people like John Hick or Paul Nitter, the liberal idea of many equally valid paths to salvation, or the view that the various religions constitute phenomenal dimensions of one transcendent noumenos, or Dingan Zish. Panikkar's view is almost the opposite. He does not think that one can trump religious pluralism by metaphysical universalism, because there is as much diversity in metaphysics and in conceptions of the ultimate as there is in religion. Furthermore, the mystery by definition cannot be objectified or made into some neutral transcendent essence of which the different faiths are manifestations. Panikkar adopts a radically apophatic attitude towards the mystery. He is deeply sympathetic to the neti neti, not this, not this, of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the mystical doctrine of the indescribability of the absolute. In the same way, he is sympathetic to the Buddhist idea of shunyata, the radical emptiness of reality. This emptiness is compatible with and can contain a relational core because it is to be interpreted in dynamic rather than static terms. If the liberal view of religious pluralism can be cryptically expressed as many parts to one and the same mountain, as in the influential view of John Hick and to some extent Paul Nitter, Panikkar's might be described as many paths up many different mountains, paths which just remain to some extent incommensurable with each other. Pluralism for Panikkar is the negotiation in respect and love with such relative incommensurability. So now, just a short section on Panikkar's philosophy of dialogue. At the relational energy at the heart of Panikkar's ontology is given expression in his theory and practice of dialogue, for which he is best known, at least in large parts of the West. Dialogue can be seen as a personalizing of this relational energy. At its deepest level, it can be regarded as a mutual recognition of the cosmotheandric mystery expressing itself in oneself and the other. But given the interrelatedness and correlationality of all being, the other should not be seen as an alien other, as an alius in Latin, and even less as an it, an aliud. The other is, properly speaking, another self, or in Paul Ricoeur's felicitous phrase, oneself as another, and conversely the other as oneself. The idea that the I would not, strictly speaking, even be without the other, that the other is my own self externalized, and that both selves are expressions of the mystery. It is this idea that provides the ontological ground for Panikkar's philosophy of interpersonal and interreligious dialogue. Of course, Panikkar is quite aware that much of what is called dialogue operates at a purely cognitive level, where the focus of the dialogue is doctrine or ideas. This is what sets up the important distinction between what he calls dialectical and dialogical dialogues. Dialectical dialogues take place at the level of doctrines and ideas. When conducted at the interpersonal level, they tend to treat members of other religions either as objects of cognitive inquiry or as subjects that are to be objectively examined and discussed. Needless to say, such dialogues have their legitimate place at the institutional or organizational level. Thus, when the Catholic Church changes its official position of, within quotes, no salvation outside the Church, extra cathedra nulla salus, or when Hindu society decides to make sati illegal, we can speak of these changes coming about as a result of dialectical dialogues. By contrast, dialogical dialogues involve the whole person and not just his or her cognitive dimension or ideas. They treat others not primarily as purveyors of objective thoughts or ideas, but as other selves, an alter in Latin, neither an aliud nor an alius, but an alter, who are independent sources of self-understanding and of a worldview not reducible to one's own. As Panikkar says, quote, the dialogical dialogue is not concerned so much about opinions as about the different viewpoints from which respective opinions are arrived at. Now, to deal with the perspective means to deal with the very fundamental springs in the knowing subject. A new epistemology is required here. Just as any knowledge of an object requires a certain co-naturality and identification with the object to be known, any knowledge of the subject necessitates a similar identification. This is what has led me, that is Panikkar, to formulate the principle of understanding as convincement. We cannot understand a person's ultimate convictions unless we somehow share them. End of quote. This thesis of understanding as convincement needs to be carefully understood because it is often misinterpreted. Panikkar is saying that one has to enter into the very mythos, the fundamental wellsprings of the thought and sensibility of one's dialogue partner, and in the process to touch on one's own mythos to the extent possible. To understand, in a sense, is to stand under the thinking and feeling of the other, not as an alien other, an alius, as is very often the case, for example, in psychoanalysis, where the methodological move of distanciation in the interests of objectivity stands in marked contrast, and still less as an it, as an aliud, in the objectifying stance of much social science and of Freudian psychoanalysis. When Panikkar talks of standing under, the new epistemology he refers to in the quotation above points to a loving knowledge, an attempt to participate sympathetically, but also critically, in the other's myth or horizon of intelligibility. And here are two somewhat long quotes of Panikkar. The dialogical dialogue challenges us on a much deeper level than the dialectical one. With the dialectical dialogue, we are unable to explore realms of human experience, spheres of reality, or aspects of being that belong to the first and second person of our grammar, that is, to the am and the art aspects of reality. He's drawing on Friedrich Ebner's speech philosophy here. In other words, with the dialectical dialogue, we can reach only the it-is aspect of the real, as against the I am and the thou art, and cannot be in full communication with the other subjects or their most intimate convictions. With the dialectical dialogue, we may discuss religious doctrines once we have clarified the context, but we need the dialogical dialogue to discuss beliefs as those conscious attitudes we have in the face of the ultimate issues of our existence and life. This seeking of our common divinity, the Atman, in one another, in and through dialogical dialogue, and making it a methodological requirement, is the challenging new element that Panikkar adds to the general discussion on dialogue. It requires us to transcend and go beyond our egos to a genuine communion with the other, seen as a thou to one's I. At the same time, it is important to see this requirement both as a hermeneutical and existential one, both as a requirement of sympathetic understanding and of respect for the other as a source of independent thinking and feeling, not reducible to one's own. It is also salient to stress that this sympathetic understanding by no means implies either an uncritical acceptance of the other's views or a surrender of one's own. Let me see. Okay, I think we have another 5 minutes maybe? Yes, okay. It should also be clear the dialogical dialogue, as Panikkar understands it, has two vectors. The deep and searching conversation with the other seen as an alter, but equally and a dialogue with oneself, where the views of the other challenge one's own. Both elements, the inter and the intra, are intertwined. The dialogue with the other is also the occasion for a profound dialogue with oneself, opening the way to a profound transformation. Otherwise expressed, the inter-religious dialogue implies an intra-religious dialogue, and vice versa. Both dialogues, dialectical and dialogical, presuppose a dialogical attitude, a disposition to be in relationship with the other. Dialogue may be regarded as underlying Panikkar's pluralism in its operational aspect. Pluralism, as I've said before, is not just diversity, but the engagement with difference and otherness, differences which may sometimes be incommensurable. Needless to say, such stark and incommensurable differences may well lead to conflict, and there are, in fact, some, like the Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington, for example, who see conflict as inevitable. Panikkar, of course, recognizes the risk of conflict, but embraces the dialogical attitude with the goal of avoiding conflict and attempting to reach deeper understanding for the sake of both social harmony and personal growth. There's a section which I'm going to skip on sort of contrasting because of the influence, maybe less now than when it first came out, of Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations. I mean, Panikkar and Huntington did have a debate which didn't end up terribly well, but nonetheless, they expressed quite different philosophies. What I just want to say in 2 minutes, because it would require more time, is at least to suggest this inner sort of transformative result of dialogue. In Panikkar's case, the theory of cosmotheandrism that I pointed out certainly came out of this, because it's at a marked remove from his neo-Thomist beginnings, where clearly in that scheme of reality there is God as hierarchically and ontologically supreme and apart, and then the created world of humans and nature, and then a further, if you want, hierarchy, given that humans are imago Dei, where humans are placed then above nature. In taking this rather horizontal view, where the cosmic, the human, and the divine are co-constitutive and interdependent, you can see that Panikkar has moved a long way from that sort of model. All right, and likewise, if I had more time, it's a technical discussion, which I would show that his doctrine of the Trinity, again, acquired a different form. I mean, and of course, Panikkar, as a Catholic theologian, was intent to say that while, of course, it was different from some formulations of the Trinity, there were other parts of the tradition to which that more, if you want, view that I articulated would be sort of faithful. So, I mean, in a sense, one of the risks of this particular style of Hindu Catholic thinking, and if, again, when you call me back, Gavin, I'll give you the the Hindu counterpart on another occasion. His books are here somewhere. The fellow who edited the Encyclopedia of Hinduism, Sheshagiri Rao, who was at Patiala, by the way, for quite a while. And of course, he too was at Patiala in sort of dialogue with Panikkar. Obviously, for the sake of some kind of symmetry and completeness, it'd be interesting to see how this dialogue sort of cuts both ways. But that's well beyond the scope of this presentation. So I'll stop there, and I'm very much looking forward to your questions and comments and criticisms and so on. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.